content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. The issue that we're reading today is dated for the week ending September 24th, 2018. On the cover, quote, I have 20 years of experience, but I can't afford to fix my car, see a doctor for headaches, or save for my child's future. I'm a teacher in America, unquote. Attributed to Nashonda Cook, Carol Magnet Middle School, Raleigh, North Carolina. Cover article by Katie Riley. To make sure that we get our interesting content in, we go right to the back of the magazine so we can include the interview feature for this edition. This time it's called Seven Questions. Time explains. The subject is Yo-Yo Ma. Time says, the legendary cellist, on the purpose of his new global tour, why culture transcends borders, and if he'd play for Donald Trump. First question. The first music you ever performed was Bach, and now you're playing his cello suites on a solo tour and recently released an album of his compositions. Why do you keep returning to him? Answer. At each stage of your life, you go back and discover new things. The way I understand Bach now is with the analogy of a river. It's like you're touching a living stream of water that keeps flowing, and by touching it, or listening to it, or playing it, you're in touch with something much bigger than yourself. It changes from day to day, from season to season, and from year to year. Question. A pillar of your tour is the concept of a culture of us. What does that mean? Answer. Culture can no longer just be tribal, because what we each do, which we think benefits us in the short term, actually impacts all of us in the long term. What can we do together that we can't do alone? I'm committing to going to these 36 communities and getting to know them, connecting with their most vulnerable citizens and the citizens who are helping one another. In Denver, we celebrated an initiative to give musical instruments to every child in the state. Now, that's pretty cool. Question. Does being an immigrant influence your music? Answer. We're all immigrants, right? The First Nation people were immigrants. But what the immigrant perspective means is you know at least two places very well, which means you can actually put two places in your head at the same time. That's what builds imagination. I need only point out that Google and Apple have co-founders that are either immigrants or first generation. That immigrant imagination allows them to see further into possibilities that don't really exist yet. Question. Is there still a place for classical music in pop culture? Answer. Things will continue to exist if people care. The percentage of calcium in our diet is probably 0.00001%. But tell me we don't need calcium. I think we live under the false premise that what is quantifiable in terms of maximum percentage has got to be good. I view music the way a health sciences person looks at DNA. Music is organized sound. It's like how the writer looks at the alphabet. Basically, is there room for more words in the world? Is there room for poetry? Is there room for novels? Is there room for rap? Question. You've performed for many presidents over the years. Would you perform for Donald Trump? Answer. The times I've performed for a president usually were state dinners. You had people from all sides of the aisle put their best selves forward. This is an incredibly important habit for all of us to practice, because if you can't talk to one another, how can you work toward a common goal? If democracy is the result of discussion, how can you stop discussing? Question. Then you would play for Trump? Answer. Civil discourse is so important. It's the basis of what allows a civilization to function. It's not about winning. The cultural part is about understanding. Final question. You've said this album is your last recording of Bach. Is this tour a victory lap? Final answer. I don't have any plans for immediate demise. I'm not suffering from an illness that is fatal other than being alive. I'm committed to thinking about cultural and social impact, because that's what I feel we need in the world at this time, to make sure that culture has an equal seat at the table as politics and economics. Without that, politics and economics will fail. I don't think there's anything more important I can do, and I will devote the rest of my life to thinking in this way. Interview with Yo-Yo Ma, legendary cellist, conducted 4 times by Raisa Bruner. We now go to the front of the magazine, and the opening major section of the magazine is the brief, and the beginning of the brief is called Opener. The subsection is Politics. The headline is GOP Senate Fears a Trump Slump by Philip Elliott. As Air Force One sped from Billings, Montana to Fargo, North Dakota on September 7th, President Donald Trump dipped into the press cabin to casually announce that he was prepared to slap another $250 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods. Quote, there's another $267 billion ready to go on short notice, if I want, unquote, Trump declared. Back on the ground, Republican strategists were soon beside themselves. The GOP is fighting to pick up Senate seats in both Montana and North Dakota, key contests that will help determine whether the party maintains control of the chamber after November's elections. Some $20 million in Montana exports to China are already caught up in Trump's ongoing trade war, and $31 million worth of North Dakota's Chinese exports are at risk, according to a U.S. Chamber of Commerce analysis. The White House never clarified exactly what Trump meant by his Air Force One remark, but any escalation of the trade war could hurt the GOP's odds in those agricultural states. The threat captured a dilemma Republicans face as they march toward Election Day. On the one hand, they need Trump on the road, tapping his popularity with the base to drive enthusiasm and turnout in November. On the other, the president's reflexive need to make himself the center of attention and his tendency to say anything at any time can hurt candidates from his party. And you never know how he's going to behave. Says one Republican official, quote, you can't trust the president on anything, unquote. The result? It's no longer just the House that could tip into Democratic hands this November. Polls in the states now suggest that the Senate is in play, too. It shouldn't be. On paper, the Senate contest this year heavily favored the GOP. For starters, Republicans are defending just 9 states, compared with the Democrats, 24, plus an additional 2 for independents who caucus with them, and 10 seats held by Democrats seeking re-election are in states Trump won in 2016, half of them by double digits. But on the ground, things don't look so good for the GOP. Of those 10 seats, Republicans are in striking distance of winning just 2, and even those races are within the margin of error. At the same time, three of the nine Republican-held seats in Nevada, Arizona, and Tennessee could be pickup opportunities for Democrats. And now, Republicans in Washington are sounding the alarm that a fourth, the one held by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, could be snatched up by the charismatic Democrat Beto O'Rourke. Buying ads in Texas's 20 media markets to try to save Cruz could be pricey. The polls show these races narrowing also point to the possible source of the problem for Republicans. Trump is increasingly losing ground with college-educated voters, especially female ones. In some recent polls, his approval rating has fallen into the high 30s from the high 40s he bragged about at the start of September. Democrats aren't ordering champagne yet, despite positive polling numbers. Party strategists recognize that they need to do everything right if they are to run the table and win difficult Senate races in costly states like Florida and conservative ones like Missouri. And Trump's unpredictability can upend Democrats' plans as much as Republicans. There is simply no telling what the mercurial Trump may get up to between now and November. For their part, many GOP officials are now confident that a strong economy will lift their candidates to victory in the Senate. But Trump has done himself and his party few favors as the fall campaign heats up. A harsh op-ed in the New York Times, credited to an unnamed senior administration official, and the latest book by journalist Bob Woodward, both paint a picture of chaos inside the Trump orbit and a president increasingly isolated from his top aides. All the while, special counsel Robert Mueller's investigations are stacking up guilty pleas and convictions. And while Trump's imprimatur was valuable to Republican candidates in the primaries, it is looking like less of an advantage in November. Party strategists lament that Trump's biggest edge comes in places with low numbers of college-educated voters, and those places often are not the metropolitan areas where Trump likes to host freewheeling, train-of-thought rallies to rant against his attorney general, the Department of Justice, and what he calls, quote, the fake news media, unquote. He likes to mock predictions that a blue wave looms this November, instead promising that a red wave of Republican victories is coming. GOP strategists worry that by doing so, Trump is depressing enthusiasm among Republicans who may believe the president is correct and their votes aren't needed. Whatever the effect of Trump's campaigning, there will be more of it, as the president plans to spend more time on the road, believing he can boost the fortunes of fellow Republicans. During the 6 weeks leading to Election Day, the White House is scheduled at least 40 days on the trail, which means one way or another, Trump will likely be a deciding factor in who wins control of the Senate in November. Entire article by Philip Elliott. On the facing page, the recurring sidebar feature called News Ticker. It consists of three news items stacked one on top of the other in the right margin. Top item: Brazil far-right candidate stabbed. Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate in Brazil's October 7th presidential elections, is in intensive care after being stabbed in the abdomen during a September 6th campaign rally. Bolsonaro's injuries mean he is unlikely to recover fully before the election. Second item: former Trump aide given 14 days in prison. George Papadopoulos, a former Trump campaign advisor, was sentenced on September 7th to 14 days in federal prison for lying to the FBI about his communications with Russians during the 2016 campaign. He was the first Trump aide to be sentenced in the special counsel investigation. Bottom item: Putin contests UK take on poisoning. Russian President Vladimir Putin said September 12th that two Russian men suspected of using the nerve agent Novichok to poison ex-spy Sergei Skripal in the UK in March were civilians, not intelligence agents, as British authorities believe. The UK has accused Moscow, which denies involvement in the attack, of, quote, obfuscation and lies, unquote. Moving ahead, we are now at the milestones page. Featured item, under died, Burt Reynolds, sexy, funny star. Observance by Stephanie Zakarik. She writes, if you went to the movies in the decade that followed 1972, you couldn't avoid Burt Reynolds. His role in that year's thriller Deliverance jump-started a seemingly unstoppable career. Reynolds, who died at age 82 on September 6th, was the affable anchor of action films and comedies. The Longest Yard, 1974, Smokey and the Bandit, 1977, that weren't always taken seriously by critics, but he was marvelous in them, a charismatic, low-key gentleman rogue. He riffed on that persona in TV talk show appearances of the day, when he showed up on Johnny Carson's show in a slightly absurd maroon suit with white piping. It was to let the audience know he knew just how ridiculous it was. But he looked amazing in anything and nothing. In 1972, he posed naked on a bearskin rug for Cosmopolitan, the drooping cigarette clenched between his teeth, drawing more attention to his slow-burning smile than to anything else. Reynolds later expressed regrets about the centerfold, saying it may have hurt his acting career. He eventually did earn an Oscar nomination in 1998 for his role in Boogie Nights, but no accolade could have made Reynolds any more charming. He had a sense of humor about everything, most of all, himself. A naked man with a cigarette at half-mast has nothing to hide. Observance by Stephanie Zakarik on Burt Reynolds. This item is accompanied by a black-and-white headshot. The caption says, Reynolds in 1972, the year his career exploded. The performer was inseparable from the personality. Under announced, Jack Ma's move, online shopping tycoon, to retire. Observance by Charlie Campbell. It's a rags-to-riches story that encapsulates a resurgent China. When Jack Ma started an online trading company from his apartment in 1999, he'd been rejected from 30 jobs and was eking out a living as a teacher. Today, Ma, 54, is China's third richest man. The firm he founded, Alibaba, is worth over $400 billion. Its online shopping platforms hawk everything from sneakers and laptops to pygmy hedgehogs, dispatching 55 million packages a day, and subsidiaries have expanded to cloud services and mobile payments. On September 10th, Ma revealed he would step down as Alibaba's executive chairman next year, September 10th. Daniel Zhang, 46, the firm's current CEO, will then take charge. Zhang shares Ma's gift for fusing commerce with entertainment. He's credited with turning China's November 11th Singles Day into the world's largest shopping event, clocking $25 billion in sales last year. Ma leaves a complicated legacy. Critics say he did little to remove fake goods from his platforms. He also failed to call out state repression. But he now plans to dedicate his time to philanthropy, meaning his tale may yet have a happy ending. Charlie Campbell, writing about Jack Ma. Under died Pittsburgh rapper Mac Miller at 26 on September 7th. He connected with fans through lyrics about substance abuse and depression. Under reopened, New York City's Cortlandt Street subway station, which was destroyed in the September 11, 2001 attacks, on September 8th, that is, reopened on September 8th. It was one of the last parts of the World Trade Center to reopen. The Cortlandt Street subway station. Under convened, a 2019 meeting of key bishops from around the world to discuss protecting children from sexual abuse by Pope Francis on September 12th. That is, 2019 meeting convened by Pope Francis. Under overturned, India's ban on sexual activity between same-sex couples by the country's Supreme Court in a historic September 6th ruling. Under held, a military parade by North Korea to celebrate its founding 70 years ago. The parade, held September 9th, did not feature the long-range missiles at the center of negotiations over denuclearization. Under named, Liana Nguyen, an ER doctor and Baltimore's health commissioner, as the next president of Planned Parenthood on September 12th. Under attacked, the Iranian and U.S. consulates in Basra, Iraq, by protesters amid tightening U.S. sanctions on Iran. The U.S. has blamed Tehran for failing to prevent the violence. That is all the content of Milestones. On the facing page, the section is still the brief, and this subsection is News. And the particular section here is Good Question, where the headline is, Why does the U.S. oppose the International Criminal Court? By Billy Perigo. On September 10th, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton launched a broadside against the International Criminal Court, parenthetically ICC, the body mandated by most of the international community to prosecute genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. In a speech to the Conservative Federalist Society, Bolton announced that Washington would, quote, use any means necessary, unquote, to push back against the organization's influence. The ICC was established in 2002 in response to human rights abuses in countries such as Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. Supported by 123 nations, it was intended to act as a, quote, court of last resort, unquote, to step in when nations' legal systems fail. Since then, it has succeeded in convicting several war criminals, even as critics have slammed its slow bureaucracy and its toothlessness in prosecuting crimes outside Africa. Bolton, however, has gone beyond those points, apparently provoked by the court's preparation to probe U.S. personnel for alleged torture of detainees in Afghanistan. He warned that Washington was ready to take steps, including banning judges of the, quote, illegitimate court, unquote, from the country and sanctioning their funds in the U.S. financial system. In common with several countries, the U.S. sees the court as a challenge to its constitutional authority. The U.S. joined Israel, China, and Saudi Arabia in refusing to ratify the ICC's founding document in 2002, citing its, quote, unacceptable consequences for our national sovereignty, unquote. A key person working on that decision was Bolton, then an Undersecretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. In the years that followed, he spearheaded the signing of approximately 100 bilateral deals to prevent countries around the world from handing Americans over to the ICC. None of these deals have ever been tested. No American has been indicted by the court. But murmurs of an investigation into war crimes in Afghanistan threaten to change that. Although the U.S. is not a member of the ICC, Afghanistan is. As a result, crimes committed on its territory can legally be brought to the court, no matter the nationality of the perpetrator. Quote, what we saw from Mr. Bolton on September 10th was a preemptive strike to intimidate the ICC, unquote, the director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, Richard Dicker, tells Time. Washington's resistance to the ICC is not new, but the threats coming from a senior administration official are. The U.S. is sending the wrong message on war crimes, not to mention that the country's refusal to cooperate could hinder other investigations, too. Quote, the first casualty here, unquote, Dicker says, quote, is any prospect of the U.S. credibly asserting itself as a champion of justice, unquote. But it seems Bolton has a different casualty in mind, quote, the ICC, unquote, he said in a speech, quote, is already dead to us, unquote. Entire article by Billy Perigo. On the same page, the subsection is restaurants, and the headline is When Fast Food Invades by Abigail Adams. She writes, Starbucks opened its first store in Italy on September 7th, but its upscale look couldn't stop skepticism in the land of espresso. Here, other chains with rough international debuts. Abigail Adams lists three examples running across the bottom of the page, left to right. First example, on the left, McDonald's. Romans protested when the Golden Arches first appeared in the Piazza di Spagna in 1986. But by 2017, McDonald's had opened over 560 branches across Italy. The chain has stores on six of the seven continents. Middle example, Taco Bell. The Mexican-themed chain has many global locations, but has repeatedly failed in Mexico. When it first tried to open in Mexico City in 1992, locals were confused by its food names. A 2007 attempt didn't work out either. Last example on the far right, Chick-fil-A. When the fast food company said in July that it planned to open its first franchisee-owned store outside the U.S. in Toronto, the news sparked online backlash among critics of its ties to conservative causes. On this page, in the far-left margin, is another edition of the recurring feature called News Ticker in sidebar form. Once again, it is three news items stacked top to bottom. Top item. Dallas police officer shoots neighbor. Dallas police officer Amber Geiger fatally shot Batom Shem John, a black man, inside his home on September 6th. She claimed she mistook the apartment for her own and has been charged with manslaughter. The case has raised questions about whether the officer, who is white, received preferential treatment. center item. Japan may lift commercial whaling ban. Japan has proposed an end to a 1986 ban on commercial whaling, saying the whale population is healthy enough for hunting to resume. Critics disagree. Japan kills 333 whales a year in the name of scientific research, though much of the meat is sold for human consumption. Final item. FEMA, that is all caps, F-E-M-A, FEMA funds went to border crackdown. The Trump administration diverted nearly $10 million from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to help pay for detention and removal operations. Senator Jeff Merkley revealed on September 11th. Officials said the move would not affect disaster relief funds. Moving ahead, and the section we are now in is still the brief, and the subsection here is Time with Former President Jimmy Carter. Time says, Jimmy Carter is still building his legacy one home at a time. Article by Molly Ball, Dateline, Mishawaka, Indiana. At 93, Jimmy Carter's gait is a little stiff, his back a little bit stooped. He doesn't swing a hammer like he once did, preferring to work at a table saw. But one week each year, the 39th President of the United States and his wife still travel somewhere in the world to build homes with their own hands for Habitat for Humanity, the global housing charity. And so, on a Thursday in late August, the Carters were on a job site in Mishawaka, Indiana, wearing blue hard hats and measuring out lengths of wood for a new patio. Home is a powerful thing to Carter, the only modern president to return there after leaving the White House. The couple still lives in the two-bedroom ranch house in Plains, Georgia, that they built in 1961, and their everyday lives bear little resemblance to the jet-setting and buck-raking of his post-presidential peers. They still cook their own meals and attend their local Baptist church, where Carter teaches Sunday school. You'll never find Carter giving a speech to an investment bank for hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's a bright, crisp morning in this suburb of South Bend, where a formerly vacant lot is being transformed into 23 vinyl-sided houses. The one the Carters are working on will soon belong to Cleora Taylor, a 36-year-old single mother of four, who will pay it off with a no-interest mortgage. Quote, we happen to be Christians, and this gives us a chance to put our religious beliefs into practical projects, unquote, Carter says in his soft country drawl. Quote, that's a very difficult thing for wealthy people to do, like we are, to cross the great barrier between us and people who have never had a decent place to live, unquote. Carter's humility might seem a rebuke to those who put more stock in material success or public glory. But he insists he doesn't judge people with different priorities. Quote, we live the way we want to live, unquote, he says. Quote, that's what we prefer, unquote. What does annoy him is the worsening inequality he sees in America, which he blames on partisan gerrymandering, voter suppression, and the Supreme Court's, quote, stupid, unquote, 2010 campaign finance decision, Citizen United. Quote, that injected large amounts of money into the political system, unquote, he says, and it, quote, has made our country more of an oligarchy depending on wealth than it is a democracy depending on individual citizens' votes, unquote. The Carters have been building for Habitat for Humanity 35 years now. He says they'll keep doing it as long as they can. Carter beat cancer in 2015, and his wife Rosalind, 91, has walked with a cane since she had surgery earlier this year. The building projects have taken them to 14 countries and 21 states, from Mississippi to Manila, and many points in between. In 2018, it seems particularly resonant that they've come to rural Indiana, in the middle of the American heartland that's been so scrutinized since Donald Trump's election. They're here as a personal favor to local architect Leroy Troyer, 80, who's been supervising their building work around the world for the past 33 years. The Carters call him, quote, boss, unquote. The former president's focus on housing also fits the moment. Some experts believe soaring home prices could again trigger a market meltdown like the 2008 financial crisis, in which housing price inflation played a prominent role. More than 38 million American households spent at least 30% of their income on housing, with nearly 19 million spending half or more, making it hard to afford other necessities. It's both a cause and a consequence of inequality, condemning people to poverty and trapping them there. The situation may seem most acute in big cities, but it's no less a problem in middle America. Poverty has doubled in Indiana since 2001, and in this Indiana county, there are more than 14,000 households spending more than 30% of their gross income on rent. On the job site, Carter wears a red bandana around his neck and a silver horseshoe belt buckle with the initials JC. Both Carters are known as taskmasters, exacting and rigorous. Quote, you want him on your build because he's so damn smart, unquote, says country music star Garth Brooks, who, with his wife, Trisha Yearwood, is on his 11th year building alongside the Carters. Quote, you might have just roofed a house, but if he sees you take a 2-second break, he'll say, quote, within the quote, do you need something to do? Unquote, unquote, says Yearwood. There was more to this article, but in the interest of getting more text and material into our reading, we move on. We do read here a sidebar feature, actually in the middle of the page, called Quick Carter Facts. There are three items, top to bottom. Top item, Nobel laureate. Carter was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002 for his post-presidential work for international peace. Middle item, polymath author. The subjects of the former president's 32 books include memoirs, policy, and woodworking. Final item, man of faith. Carter, an evangelical Christian, gave this year's commencement address at Liberty University. Before we leave, there was a final quote featured in red in the middle of the article. Quote, I have great confidence in the future of my country, unquote, attributed to Jimmy Carter. Moving ahead, we're now in the major section called The View. The subsection here is Society. The headline is Safety, Not Numbers by Jill Filipovich. She writes, it took 12 women to push one man from his perch. Leslie Moonves, the chairman and CEO of CBS, departed the company after a total of a dozen sexual harassment and assault allegations were leveled against him, six over a month ago, then six more on September 9. After weeks of discussions but little action on ousting one of TV's titans. This is how these cases seem to go. One person speaks out, or maybe two or three talk to a reporter. Only after the initial accusations are made public do the floodgates open. This cascading effect, that it's tough to get anyone to speak out first, but it appears almost inevitable that more voices will then follow, illuminates some of the remaining challenges of combating sexual harassment across our culture. We now seem to expect that a harasser will have a long list of victims, regardless of whether he or she is famous. But there are consequences to that assumption. It inevitably makes it harder for a single accuser to make her claims heard. When part of validating a claim is seeing who else has had a similar experience, a dearth of other voices becomes a strike against the veracity of the accuser's story, regardless of fairness. This, in turn, perpetuates harassment. When multiple accusations becomes the standard, a harasser has more leeway to harass. In some of the highest profile Me Too cases, that meant years or even decades of abuse. Had a single substantiated story been enough to level serious consequences, less havoc would have been wreaked on women's lives and livelihoods. There is, after all, always a first victim. Workplaces are increasingly mandating sexual harassment training and publishing clearer reporting guidelines. Several states and municipalities are moving to formalize new requirements. The most expansive may be in New York State, where employers will soon have to inform workers of how they can report harassment. By next month, employers will need to have a policy on the books and annually train all employees in prevention. Already, the state has barred employers from mandating that sexual harassment claims be resolved in arbitration, among further reforms. These efforts are commendable, parenthetically, if a headache for employers. But as the requirements develop, we risk setting our false assumptions in stone. Another example. Contrary to past thinking, sexual harassment is more about power than desire. And a man doesn't have to be Les Moonves or Harvey Weinstein or a reality TV star reality magnate to have power over others. He could be the manager of a store, the owner of a restaurant, a partner at a law firm, a fellow worker who feels that by virtue of his gender, race, education, or marginal seniority, he has authority over those around him. As they build their new structures, then, companies must create paths to reporting that don't presume the accuser and the accused are on equal standing. But changing a place's culture is, frankly, hard to legislate and often ephemeral. So companies must scout for what they've overlooked in the past. Are there significant numbers of women in senior roles? Are there people who may not be harassers but who bully subordinates? People whose behavior is written off as, quote, Bob just being Bob, unquote. It is not enough to assume that progress will win out, even after change takes place. Yes, we're in a moment when women, and many men, are collectively appalled at how high assailants were allowed to rise. I'll repeat that with clarity. It is not enough to assume that progress will win out, even after change takes place. Yes, we're in a moment when women, and many men, are collectively appalled at how high assailants were allowed to rise. And feminist shifts have let us more clearly see harassment in that context, and not as a personal quirk. Parenthetically, quote, that's just how Harvey is, unquote. Or a natural outcome. Parenthetically, quote, that's just how men are, unquote. Yet, well into the Me Too era, some of the CBS board reportedly knew that a woman had gone to the police to file a criminal sexual assault complaint against Moonves, and they still didn't take public action until an article in The New Yorker embarrassed them into it. Parenthetically, Moonves has denied the allegations. If this is how a moneyed, PR-conscious company behaves, imagine how negligently others act. This is why multiple accusations cannot be a standard in the new world we build. One report of harassment should have spurred CBS into action. It's critical that, be it at a big company against a famous man, or in a small workplace against a middle manager, a single accusation isn't treated as evidence of an inadequate claim, rather as one of many opportunities to curtail harassment as it begins. Entire article written by Jill Filipovich. Time notes, Filipovich is a lawyer and the author of The H Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. Filipovich is spelled F-I-L-I-P-O-V-I-C, Jill Filipovich. This article does include a half-length, full-color photo. The caption says, Moonves had led CBS Corp for 15 years before stepping down. On the same page is the recurring feature called Short Reads. It's a sidebar. Time says, highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. Time lists three items, top to bottom. Top item, when tolerance is intolerant. Quote, we are quick to demand tolerance, but loath to extend it to others, unquote, writes Senator Orrin Hatch. He argues people should recommit to pluralism, which, quote, recognizes that there is not just one way to achieve the good life, but multiple, and it does its best to accommodate for each, unquote. Middle item, the costs of paranoia. Psychologist Michelle Gelfand, author of the new book, Rulemakers, Rule Breakers, writes that societies have historically responded to threats by sacrificing liberty for social cohesion. The trouble today, Gelfand says, is that America is doing the same in response to manufactured or exaggerated concerns. Michelle, spelled M-I-C-H-E-L-E, last name Gelfand, spelled G-E-L-F-A-N-D. The book title, Rule Makers, Rule Breakers. Final item, after being banished. Quote, I'm not a criminal or a radical, unquote, writes NBA player Enes Kanter, who says he was barred by the Turkish government from going to his home nation after he denounced its president, which he will keep doing. Quote, I need to speak out or my country will suffer in silence, unquote. These items are on time.com/ideas in full. On the facing page, a recurring feature called The Risk Report. The headline is, China may meet Russia for war games, but that doesn't make them allies, by Ian Bremmer. On September 11th, an estimated 300,000 Russian soldiers one-third of the country's armed forces, began joint military exercises with Chinese forces in eastern Siberia. Called Vostok 18, Russia's war games with China have been labeled a rehearsal for a, quote, large-scale conflict, unquote, by NATO, and will put the Pentagon on edge. Should Americans and Europeans fear that Russia and China are moving closer together? To be fair, this is less a joint exercise than a massive Russian drill with Chinese participation. Vostok 18 reportedly features 1,000 aircraft and 36,000 tanks, but only 3,200 of the troops and 900 of the tanks are from China. And Mongolia and Turkey were also invited to take part. Even so, this will be the first time the People's Liberation Army has taken part in the quadrennial Russian military exercise, with this year, which this year is the largest since before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Russia and China share more than just a 2,600-mile border. The most obvious commonality is a desire to prevent Washington from curbing both countries' growing influence within their respective neighborhoods and beyond. Their dominance of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a Central Asian security forum made up of 8 member states, helps them push back against the U.S. presence in Asia. But the Vostok 18 exercises bring them shoulder to shoulder for an impressive show of strength. Pooling their military might reinforce the message that Washington's criticism of their behavior inside and outside of their own borders is unwelcome. Russia and China also have a natural commercial partnership in energy. Russia is among the world's leading exporters of oil and natural gas. China consumes vast amounts of these commodities. At a moment when the U.S. has slapped Russia with sanctions and China with tariffs, the Vostok exercises signal to Washington that the harder these two countries are pushed, the more they are incentivized to work together. Yet Russia and China remain incompatible partners, and over time, they're more likely to compete than cooperate. First, each country wants to establish preeminence in Central Asia. China has invested heavily in infrastructure, transport, and energy in former Soviet republics like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan via its Belt and Road Initiative. And Russia doesn't have the economic clout to compete. As a result, China dominates a region that Russia considers its security underbelly. And while China wants to buy the energy Russia sells, it has many more willing suppliers than Russia has buyers. That means China can drive a hard bargain on price that limits the volumes Russia is willing to offer. This imbalance means their foreign policy interests often diverge. When, for example, tensions rise between Iran and the U.S., China would benefit from an outcome that keeps energy prices low. Russia would prefer a scenario where they rise. There's a limit, too, to China's desire to embrace Russia. China's future security and prosperity depend more on the strength of its economy than its military. And Russia is only its 11th largest foreign trade partner, behind Japan, Germany, and even the Netherlands. The Chinese-Russian commercial relationship is the main factor limiting Russia's importance to China, even at a time when U.S. tariffs have set Chinese teeth on edge. So while China is willing to play a feature role in a Russian choreographed show of force, its future depends more on good relations with the U.S. and EU than with Russia. That hasn't changed. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. We go to the section called The Nation, which contains the cover story, the title of which is The Life of the American Teacher by Katie Riley. Katie Riley includes an article featuring Nashonda Cook, 43. She is at Carroll Leadership in Technology Magnet Middle School, Raleigh, North Carolina. Quote, I have been teaching for almost 20 years, but I make about $69,000 a year, and I still depend on my mom sometimes. I've been running around with a crack in my windshield for 3 months because I can't afford the more than $200 deductible on my car insurance. I'm terrified that I won't have anything to put toward my oldest daughter's college education. Unquote. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That is TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. So long until next time, we certainly hope you will join us next time for Time Magazine.